Hello, and welcome to the Nauticast podcast, the one true chapter-by-chapter podcast going through A Song of Ice and Fire. I'm one of your hosts, Emmett, also known as Poor Quentin.
And I'm your other host, Manu, also known as Manuclear Bomb.
And welcome to the 219th episode of the Nauticast, titled Turning the Page, an analysis of A Storm of Swords, Jamie 9, in which George sets up a bunch of storylines for the next couple books. And yeah, there's a beautiful scene between Jamie and Brienne at the end, but mostly this is a chapter about remembering that Jane Poole exists.
Of all the plot points I'd like to eternal sunshine out of my brain, I would say Jane Poole's is number one.
That's the one you want to experience again over for the first time?
Oh, wait, no, I just want it gone.
Oh, you just want it? That's much better. Gone forever. I was thinking that, yeah, poor Theon, if only he could be sent to the Eternal Sunshine Factory. There would be a long line of Aeswath characters waiting out that door. They'd all be there. So our spoiler warning, as always, prepare to be spoiled for the 5 A Song of Ice and Fire novels, the 3 Duncan Egg novellas, any histories, any interviews, the Winds of Winter sample chapters, as well as Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon, the TV shows. Anything and everything. Our question this episode comes from our patron Banksy, who asks, will King Tommen have time to develop any actual policies, or will the prophecy get him before he can? Well, I think, you know, no beats is a policy. I think it's a controversial one. It's not one that I personally would get behind. But I do love King Tommen's pro-cats policy. I'll be voting for him on that basis. What do you think? Is Tommen going to have any time to make any decisions before he dies horribly?
No. Next. Next. No, I really don't think. I just don't think there's any way the story is structured unless George, I don't know, puts a 5-year time gap in between Winds and
in the middle of Winds, in between chapters.
Maybe. But I still don't think that like interregnum would be filled with Tommen like hashing out like a comprehensive new deal for Westeros.
I would love it.
And like reorganizing the social contract. No, I think unfortunately he just dies. I do hope he gets like something like pass just like for shits and giggles, like outlawing whipping boys. I feel like that would be a good thing for Tommen's. Like, I've seen how awful this is, horrendous practice, let's get rid of it. And Cersei would be like, yeah, I can give him that one.
I'll grant him that one before I end up getting him killed somehow. Yeah, this is one case where I think the age difference between the book and the show changed the character, because Tommen, of course, in the show is a little older. Still, I think, being manipulated by the Tyrells and the Sparrows when he started taking action on his own. But he was taking action on his own and being out there, you know, performing the role of kingship. I like that little scene at Joffrey's graveside, by Joffrey's body, where Tommen and Tywin are talking about the next step, and Tommen says, I think I'll be a better king than him, and Tywin says, yeah, I think you will be too. Because we don't see much of Tommen, but Joffrey set the bar pretty low. I think Tommen would probably be just fine. He seems like a nice kid. He doesn't seem to have any of the anger, any of the juice in him that his brother had. But yeah, I think Tommen in the books, I think the closest hint we get to him making a decision on his own is that Margaery is trying to influence him and trying to get him away from Cersei. And so he sees like Tommen's like, oh, maybe we should appoint this guy to be my master at arms. Obviously, he's not coming up with these ideas, but I think the closest we'll get is that Tommen continues to do what Margaery tells him, and that makes Cersei really, really mad. On the long list of things that will make Cersei really, really mad. Just add another one.
It's already making her mad in this chapter, so
exactly.
It's simmering.
I love the how Cersei like wants Tommen to like make his own decisions and thinks, you know, Joffrey, he was much tougher. He had will of his own. But then whenever Tommen does that, Cersei hates it. she knows he has to be his own man, but she can't let him do it. The classic overbearing mother problem that Cersei has in spades. So thank you to Banksy, not the real Banksy, I can only assume, for the question. If you want to ask us questions that we answer here on the Nauticast podcast, you can head on over to patreon.com/nauticast, A-S-O-I-A-F, where our patrons get benefits including early access to our regular episodes, multiple exclusive episodes every month, and the chance to ask us questions that we answer at the top of our regular A Song of Ice and Fire episodes. But speaking of A Song of Ice and Fire, we're here with everyone's favorite character, Jaime Lannister, but especially yours. So as usual, I throw it over to you, sir.
The king sat at the head of the table, a stack of cushions under his arse, signing each document as it was presented to him. Oh, to be an 8-year-old king, ass on what I presume is the comfiest pillow in the realm, condemning the high lords who rebelled against your crown. Sounds really nice. Well, at least for Tommen. For Jaime Lannister, this is boring. Sure, Jaime will have to face down these attainted lords in the next book, namely the Tullys, and those risen up in their place, namely the Freys, but I can forgive him for daydreaming all the same. Everyone apparently wants a seat at this table, yet Jaime can't figure out why. They can bloody well have mine. If this was power, why did it taste like tedium? He did not feel especially powerful. Watching Tommen dip his quill in the inkpot again, he felt bored and sore. Every muscle in his body ached, and his ribs and shoulders were bruised from the battering they'd gotten, courtesy of Sir Adam Marbrand. Just thinking of it made him wince. He could only hope the man would keep his mouth shut. Jaime had known Marbrand since he was a boy, serving as a page at Casterly Rock. He trusted him as much as he trusted anyone. Enough to ask him to take up shields and tourney swords. He had wanted to know if he could fight with his left hand. And now I do. Turns out, Jaime sucks shit with his left hand. And not just like got beaten suck shit, but can barely hold onto his sword suck shit, which is some real shit sucking. The aches and pains are enough to distract him from the honors being bestowed upon the Red Wedding conspirators. The North to Roose Bolton, legitimacy to his bastard son, and Castamere to the Spicers. I should have gone to Sir Ilan Payne, Jaime reflected. The king's justice was not a friend as Marbrand was, and might well have beat him bloody. But without a tongue, he was not like to boast of it afterward. All it would take would be one chance remark by Sir Adam in his cups, and the whole world would soon know how useless he'd become. Lord Commander of the Kingsguard. It was a cruel jape, though not quite so cruel as the gift his father had sent him. As Jaime dismisses himself, his uncle speaks up. Jaime, you should go to your father. This breach between you is his doing, nor will he mend it by sending me mocking gifts. Tell him that, if you can pry him away from the Tyrells long enough. His uncle looked distressed. The gift was heartfelt. We thought it might encourage you to grow a new hand. Jaime turns to his young, pink, round nephew son of a king and takes his leave, while Tommen moves on to the sealing of letters. Hey, he's got a bit of that war criminal grandfather in him, winning wars with ink and ravens. We might make a king out of you yet, Tommen Baratheon. Golden Shroud prophecies be damned. Jaime makes for the stables, where Steelshanks and his men are readying for the long road north. But they aren't going alone. They're also taking along the most depressing story in George's entire saga. A groom led a fine gray mare out of the stable door. On her back was mounted a skinny, hollow-eyed girl wrapped in a heavy cloak. Gray, it was, like the dress beneath it, and trimmed with white satin. The clasp that pinned it to her breast was wrought in the shape of a wolf's head with slitted opal eyes. The girl's long brown hair blew wild in the wind. She had a pretty face, he thought, but her eyes were sad and wary. When she saw him, she inclined her head. "Sir Jaime," she said in a thin, anxious voice, "you are kind to see me off." Jaime studied her closely. "You know me, then?" She bit her lip. "You may not recall, my lord, as I was littler then, but I had the honor to meet you at Winterfell when King Robert came to visit my father, Lord Eddard." She lowered her big brown eyes and mumbled, "I'm Arya Stark." It isn't Arya Stark, and Jaime knows that. The only thing more obvious than how Arya Stark she isn't is how frightened she clearly is. Jamie's aware it's not the girl that matters, but the name, and bids the party fare thee well as they ride out of the gate. Then it's just Jaime in the stable, him and the deep blood stains of the boy Gregor Clegane cut in half in Tyrion 10. Clegane pays for his sins now, though, rotting away in the Maester's Tower as even maggots refuse this mountainous feast. Pycelle explains, "The veins in his arm are turning black. When I leeched him, all the leeches died. My lords, I must know what malignant substance Prince Oberyn used at his spear. Let us detain those other Dornishmen until they are more forthcoming." Lord Tywin had refused him. "There will be enough trouble with Sunspear over Prince Oberyn's death. I do not mean to make matters worse by holding his companions captive." "Then I fear Sir Gregor may die." "Undoubtedly. I swore as much in the letter I sent to Prince Doran with his brother's body. But it must be seen to be the sword of the king's justice that slays him, not a poison spear. Heal him." "My lord, heal him." Lord Tywin's greatest fear is not insufficient justice for Prince Doran, but rather the Dornish allying with Stannis, who has sailed from Dragonstone and gone to who knows where. What Tywin does know is that Stannis Baratheon is relentless, and if he has left, it is to resume his campaign for the throne. Wherever he's gone, though, the Dornish Rift must be healed, and for that, Tywin needs Clegane healed. And so the mountain screamed, day and night. Lord Tywin Lannister could cow even the stranger, it would seem. Returning to quarters for the evening, Jaime finds his sister lover waiting, all in white. If there's one thing you gotta give Cersei, she knows how to dress for the occasion. Cersei, why are you here?
Where else could I go?
When she turned to him, there were tears in her eyes.
Father's made it clear that I'm no longer wanted on the council. Jaime, won't you talk to him?
I talk to Lord Tywin every day.
Must you be so stubborn? All he wants
is to force me from the Kingsguard and send me back to Casterly Rock.
Then you'd not be so terrible. He is sending me back to Casterly Rock as well. He wants me far away, so he'll have a free hand with Tommen. Tommen is my son, not his.
Tommen is the king.
He is a boy.
And not just any boy, but a lucky boy. And that, I mean, he's teed up to be Marjorie Tyrell's third husband. Jaime seems little harm in this. Tommen is his seed, not his son, and Tommen might be better off with Marjorie and her flock of hens than the den of lions surrounding him now. Jaime had disinvolved himself from Tommen's life on Cersei's command, out of fear of Robert, a fear now resting 6 feet under. Robert's death still left a bitter taste in Jaime's mouth. Should have been me who killed him, not Cersei. I only wish he'd died at my hands, when I had still two of them. If I'd let Kingslaying become a habit, as he'd like to say, I could have taken you as my wife for all the world to see. I'm not ashamed of loving you, only of the things I've done to hide it. That boy at Winterfell.
Did I tell you to throw him out the window? If you'd gone hunting as I begged you, nothing would have happened. But no, you had to have me. You cannot wait until we return to the city.
Jaime remembered something else. Catelyn Stark had accused him of sending an assassin for the little boy Jaime defenestrated. What was that about?
Beats me, responds Cersei.
They both wish the small child had died, like good people do, but after a little bit of thought, the answer becomes obvious. It was their bastard of a bastard son, trying to impress his drunken not-a-dad. He had an uncomfortable thought. Tyrion almost died because of this bloody dagger. If he knew the whole thing was Joffrey's work, that might be why. Cersei could give less of a shit about why, though here in her grief, Cersei seems as sincere and heartfelt as we've seen on page so far. With Joffrey dead and Myrcella in the south, Tommen is all she has, and maybe, maybe, Jaime can convince their father to let her keep him, especially if he agrees to leave the Kingsguard.
His sister fought back tears. Jaime, you're my shining knight. You cannot abandon me when I need you most. He is stealing my son, sending me away. And unless you stop him, father is going to force me to wed again.
Who?
Doesn't matter. Some lord or other. Someone father thinks he needs. I don't care. I will not have another husband. You are the only man I want in my bed, ever again.
Then tell him that. She pulled her hands away.
You are talking madness again. Would you have us ripped apart, as mother did that time she caught us playing? Tommen would lose the throne, Myrcella her marriage. I want to be your wife. We belong to each other. But it can never be, Jaime. We are brother and sister.
The Targaryens.
We are not Targaryens!
Cersei tries a different tact, a more sexy tact, but Jaime refuses. Unadulterated incest sex may be okay in a church, but it was hardly appropriate for the barracks. For an instant, he could see confusion in her bright green eyes, and fear as well. Then rage replaced it.
Was it your hand they hacked off in Harrenhal, or your manhood?
I was a fool to come. You lacked the courage to avenge Joffrey. Why would I think that you'd protect Tommen?
Tell me, if the imp had killed all three of your children, would that have made you wroth?
Tyrion is not going to harm Tommen or Myrcella. I'm still not certain he killed Joffrey.
How can you say that? After all his threats?
Threats mean nothing. He swears he did not do it.
Oh, he swears, is that it? And dwarfs don't lie, is that what you think?
Not to me, no more than you would.
You great golden fool. He's lied to you 1,000 times, and so have I. I've been fucking Lancel and Osmond Kettleblack and sorry, getting a bit ahead of myself there. Angrily and mockingly, Cersei takes her leave. I've lost a hand, a father, a son, a sister, and a lover, and soon enough I will lose a brother. And yet they keep telling me House Lannister won this war. A wee bit later, Sir Loras arrives with Brienne of Tarth in tow. Loras has had a chance to question Brienne, and it turns out she may not be so crazy after all. Nothing about it quite makes sense, but Brienne is pretty truthful, and there's also the inexplicable death of Courtney Penrose in the mix. Happy with the results, Jaime dismisses Loras and is left alone with his non-sister lover. The wench looked as ugly and awkward as ever, he decided when Tyrell left them. Someone had dressed her in woman's clothes again, but this dress fit much better than that hideous pink rack the goat had made her wear. Blue is a good color on you, my lady, Jaime observed. It goes well with your eyes. She does have astonishing eyes. Brienne glanced down at herself, flustered. Septa Denise patted out the bodice to give it that shape. She said you sent her to me. She lingered by the door, as if she meant to flee at any second. You look different. He managed a half-smile. More meat on the ribs and fewer lice in my hair, that's all. The stump's the same. Close the door and come here. The white cloak is new, but I'm sure I'll soil it soon enough. I was about to say that it becomes you. She came closer, hesitant. Gosh, this is so darn cute, like a high school rom-com. Brienne's never been kissed, and Jaime's never been kissed by someone aside from his sister, so both are a little awkward. Jamie's not really interested in debating Renly's fate, though. The important thing is Loras was off Jamie's back. No, Jaime called her here about the Stark sisters, including the supposed Arya heading north with Steelshanks. The key here is, she's not Arya Stark. Not Arya Stark? You heard me. My lord father found some skinny northern girl more or less the same age with more or less the same coloring. He dressed her up in white and gray, gave her a silver wolf to pin her cloak, and sent her off to wed Bolton's bastard. He lifted his stump to point at her. I wanted to tell you that before you went galloping off to rescue her and got yourself killed for no good purpose. You're not half bad with the sword, but you're not good enough to take on 200 men by yourself. When Lord Bolton learns that your father paid him with false coin... Oh, he knows. Lannisters lie, remember? Makes no matter. This girl serves his purpose just as well. Who is going to say that she isn't Arya Stark? Everyone the girl was close to is dead except her sister, who has disappeared. Why would you tell me all this if it's true? You are betraying your father's secrets. The hand secrets, he thought. I no longer have a father. I pay my debts like every good little lion. I did promise Lady Stark her daughters, and one of them is still alive. My brother may know where she is. If so, he isn't saying. Cersei is convinced that Sansa helped him murder Joffrey. No, it was not my lady's daughter. It could not have been her. There's the stubborn, stupid wench that I remember, she reddened. My name is Brienne of Tarth, Jaime sighed. I have a gift for you. Jaime proceeds to whip it out, though it is a blade ordained with rubies, black and blood rippling through the steel. Is this... Valyrian steel? I have never seen such colors. Nor I. There was a time that I would have given my right hand to wield a sword like that. Now it appears I have, so the blade is wasted on me. Take it. A sword so fine must bear a name. It would please me if you would call this one Oathkeeper. One more thing. The blade comes with a price. Her face darkened. I told you, I will never serve such foul creatures as us. Yes, I recall. Hear me out, Brienne. Both of us swore oaths concerning Sansa Stark. Cersei means to see that the girl is found and killed, wherever she has gone to ground. Brienne's homely face twisted in fury. If you believe that I would harm my lady's daughter for a sword, you just listen, he snapped, angered by her assumption. I want you to find Sansa first and get her somewhere safe. How else are the two of us going to make good our stupid vows to your precious dead Lady Catelyn? The wench blinked. I know what you thought. When Ned Stark died, his greatsword was given to the king's justice. But my father felt such a fine blade was wasted on a mere headsman. He gave Sir Ilyn a new sword and had ice melted down and reforged.
There was enough metal for two new blades. You're holding one, so you'll be defending Ned Stark's daughter with Ned Stark's own steel, if that makes any difference to you. Brienne tries to apologize, obviously having read Jaime wrong, but he's annoyed and dismisses her. I have made kings and unmade them. Sansa Stark is my last chance for honor. Jaime smiled thinly. Besides, Kingslayers should band together. Are you ever going to go? Her big hand wrapped tight around Oathkeeper. I will, and I will find the girl and keep her safe, for her lady mother's sake, and for yours. She bowed stiffly, whirled, and went. And now it's just Jaime and a giant fucking book with too little about him in it. He remedies that last half by detailing his tumult during the War of the Five Kings and giving credit to Brienne for saving him. Sir Gerald Hightower had begun his history, and Sir Barristan Selmy had continued it, but the rest Jaime Lannister would need to write for himself. He could write whatever he chose henceforth. Whatever he chose. And that is your synopsis for A Storm of Swords, Jaime 9. What did you think, sir?
Great job, sir. I loved your Pycelle voice especially. That was perfect. That's going to replace, what's his name, Julian Glover in my head now.
The highest compliment.
So this is kind of a strange chapter because it builds to one of the most important and emotional scenes in Jaime's story, along with Brienne's. But a lot of what comes before that doesn't feel specific to Jaime. It's almost a break from the POV structure. It's information that any character could be receiving on behalf of the audience. George has to cram in this exposition and setup for later storylines now because the last chapter in this book, set in King's Landing, Tyrion 11, has no room for context. It is stripped down to the bone. So Jaime 9 has to be the load-bearing chapter. But it's a lot more enjoyable than that sounds. Exposition isn't inherently a problem, not if it's executed well, and George pulls that off, probably knowing that this chapter might end up boring if he didn't give it a sense of momentum, smoothly flowing from one little scene to the next as Jaime gets more and more alienated by everything and everyone until he finally glimpses hope with Brienne. That's his arc in a nutshell, so while this chapter isn't unique in the same way previous Jaime chapters were, it's more of a microcosm of his journey. It sums up the whole thing.
As we wind down A Storm of Swords, we've been tracking how this book leaves off each of our point of view characters. Daenerys, as we saw last time out, sits her ass down in Meereen as queen to begin her rule. Jon's election will also serve this purpose. Arya and Bran are both launched into a new phase of their adventures, across the Narrow Sea and beyond the Wall respectively. Tyrion too will wrap things up neatly. Kinda, before surgeoning east as well. Sansa's already begun her transition into Feast at the Vale. And in all these cases, we say goodbye to the point of view and character until the next slate of books. But not Jaime. Oh no. Jaime was already George's shot across the bow in A Storm of Swords, Chapter 1, to let you know we are playing a whole new ballgame. But it's his ending that sticks out to me. Excepting Sam, he's the only point of view we get to see after his last chapter, you know, in Tyrion 11, and in that appearance when he frees Tyrion and spills the Tysha tea, Jaime takes perhaps his most consequential act. Which is what makes Jaime 9 so fascinating in retrospect and his arc as a whole. It still has a curtain call pending after his last paragraph. So, I really can't get over Tommen's ass cushion. It's probably got the highest feather count in all of Westeros. Really fit for a king. Secondly, it acts as a fun semi-callback to Winterfell in early A Game of Thrones, where Tommen was a padded king in his armor with in his practice bouts with Bran. Similar imagery, a soft, round little lad insulated to keep him comfortable and pain-free. It's a potent symbol for how removed Tommen is going to be from the actual politicking in his kingdoms, and the length Cersei will go to protect him, something we'll talk about later in this chapter. And of course, being seated on the kingdom's cushiest padding is a sign of the wealth and privilege that Tommen's crown is built on. The small council's mission is clear. To keep that figurehead boy king alive and safe, and they can basically rule in his stead. It will be tensions within that small council and surrounding advisors which will drive forward a lot of the King's Landing story in A Feast for Crows following the death of Tywin.
Back when we covered the Purple Wedding, I said the big joke of Joffrey's death is that it doesn't really matter. Nothing much changes politically. One exception, though. What does change is that the Lannister adults no longer have to deal with a sadistic child king in love with his own power and prone to doing things like executing Ned Stark for no goddamn reason. Now they have Tommen, and the big joke here is that Tommen has no interest in power whatsoever. He will happily do whatever the adults tell him to. You know, we talk about old age as the second childhood, and this reminds me of Ronald Reagan, who for the last, he was kind of checked out for the last all of his presidency. And it's always been pretty clear that his advisors were doing the actual work of running the country, and he was more or less the figurehead for them. And kind of Tommen is the same thing on the opposite end of the age spectrum, too young to really be in charge of the government himself. Now, that changes a little in the next book when Margaery gets involved. She starts subtly manipulating him into defying Cersei. But for now, Tommen's just a kid. Joffrey was old enough that you could see the adult he could have become. Like, right before he died, Tyrion was thinking, like, okay, 3 years until he's ruling on his own. That's actually not that much time. Tommen is so young that he doesn't really have a personality outside of liking cats, hating beets, and being nice to everybody. With Joffrey, there was this tension between all the blood being shed to keep him in power and the reality that he, as king, would only shed more blood. Mm-hmm. Like, this is what Tywin realized when Joffrey defied him, and Tyrion thought, wow, Dad's really upset about this, because Tywin realized, oh, there is no peace to be had under King Joffrey's rule. That's not going to satisfy him. With Tommen, the tension is that he appears to have no idea that blood is being shed to keep him on his cushy little booster seat. Mm-hmm. And I love that's when we first see Tommen as king. Like, compared to the first time we saw Joffrey as king, that really dramatic scene where Ned's going into the throne room with his paper shield, and you got Joffrey on the throne, and Cersei's next to him, and the Kingsguard all around him. And this is the first time we see Tommen as king, and he's not on the throne, he's on his cushy little booster seat. It's a perfect way to set up of how different the child kings are going to be. But every document Tommen signs here is a reflection of the power dynamics of a Westeros at war. He may as well be signing in blood. The Tullys won't simply accept being stripped of their castle, and even as the Boltons climb the ladder, they have made plenty of local enemies. So are these documents creating peace, or are they simply setting the stage for the next part of the war? Same applies to this whole chapter. You have this surface appearance of peace, like the Lannisters are trying to project, hooray, the war is now over. But there are plenty of murky, bloody realities waiting under that surface. In other words, the opening of this chapter, I think, contrasts Tommen's POV with Jaime's. Like, from the child's POV, everything's fine, just doing my job, stamping the little papers, and Jaime's is just this exhausted, weary adult POV that has barely crawled out of the war and isn't really feeling like much was gained.
Yeah, that's exactly right. While Tommen's having a blast being the crowned notary of the Seven Kingdoms, Jaime's just bored out of his mind. There's that old adage, war is interminable boredom punctuated by moments of terror. And there's that other old adage by Prussian General Karl von Clausewitz, war is the continuation of policy with other means. Thus, the transitive property would have it that politics, too, is interminable boredom punctuated by moments of terror.
It's just math.
In fact, that kind of sums up the court intrigue of A Song of Ice and Fire, especially when wedding planning is involved. Jaime really should be paying attention, though. His entire feast story is previewed right here. While I mentioned that Jaime still has a part to play in Storm after his point of view ends, George very organically preps us for his Riverland adventures. The fate of the Tullys, spoil for the Freys and Spicers and Boltons, and cleaning up other messes from the War of the Five Kings is something the Lannister regime needs to secure right here and now, especially with the later news about Stannis being on the move. Shoring up the power base that helped depose the Starks and bringing the rebellious kingdoms back into the fold are top priorities. So yes, George is previewing each of the houses and their relationships to the crown, but that's not all. He also foreshadows Jaime's midnight joust with Sir Ilyn Payne, which we'll talk about a little bit more later on. Jaime's coming off a night of dueling Sir Adam Marbrand, getting a sense for where his sword skills stand from the left. Turns out, not very good. Very clearly a metaphor when Jaime describes everything as backwards. He's not a warrior anymore, he's a diplomat. He's going to need to command, to politic, to do war by other means to hit that adage again. I think it's no mistake that this chapter opens with Jaime struggling to wield a sword and ends with him instead struggling to wield a pen.
It's almost like he's being reborn. We saw that at Harrenhal with the bathtub almost being like the womb. And in this chapter, we get all the white imagery and Jaime's like learning how to use his body again. It's almost like he's the same age as Tommen. He even says at the end of the chapter when he's writing in the book that it looks like a kid writing, looks like a kid's handwriting who just learned how to write. That's kind of where Jaime is right now. And I love the bit where Jaime says the real problem with fighting with his other hand is he has to think about every move he makes, whereas before he could just act on instinct. That's the benefit of having been a fighter for years. But that applies to more than just swordsmanship. When Jaime lost his hand, it forced him to not only use his other hand, it also forced him to use parts of his mind and soul that he'd been neglecting. Jaime hasn't really been thinking for years. The horror of the Mad King's final days, the alienation in terms of how Jaime was treated by everyone afterward, the pressure of keeping both the wildfire and his relationship with Cersei secret, all of these have compounded to create compartmentalization. Jaime acts on instinct everywhere, not just the battlefield. He fights, he fucks his sister, he displays total contempt for everyone else, the end. And everything else that's in him he keeps below the surface, hidden even from himself. From the start of the book, however, we have seen Jaime begin to mentally and emotionally re-engage with the world around him, sometimes without even realizing it, leading to contradictions between his words, thoughts, and actions that we've talked about before. Like in his first chapter, at the very end when he was reaching out with an oar to Brienne, he thought, I'll just hit her, I'll get rid of her, and then he found himself using it to help her get back on board. He didn't even understand what he was doing, why he was doing it. And even before Jaime lost his hand, he was set back on his heels by his loss to Robb at the Whispering Wood, and his subsequent imprisonment beneath River Run. Not only did that humiliate Jaime, cutting through his self-image as the man who could keep anyone and anything at bay with a sword, but it also gave Jaime time to think. Time with nothing else to do but think. And now here he is, sitting and stewing as his family carries on ruling like none of that ever happened, and he's like basically not even here. And that's what really, I think, gets to him about the present of the sword that he gives to Brienne, which he and Kevon briefly fight about here, kind of setting that up for later. Not only is it a thoughtlessly cruel gift, as Jaime says, it just reminds him that he can't grow a hand back to use it, but it also betrays Tywin's desire to pretend that nothing has changed and he can reshape Jaime at will. If Tywin really meant that gift as a reconciliation, it just proves that he doesn't understand why Jaime defied him the last time they spoke. This sword papers over the reality that Jaime feels like he has no true home in his own family anymore, and no external symbol is going to change that.
The first act of this chapter sets up several of Feast for Crows plotlines, but not to be outdone, the second act sets up my favorite plotline of A Dance with Dragons, that of Reek and the Northern Court at Winterfell. But at the center of that story is the returning Jane Poole doing a non-consensual cosplay of Arya Stark. The plight of Jane is one of the most heartbreaking aspects of the story, and one we will dive deeply into when we get to Dance. But we shouldn't ignore the fact that her last year or so under the care of Littlefinger was probably awful in the ways you can expect from Littlefinger, which further deepens Baelish's betrayal of Sansa, having held her best friend this entire time. There's so much to hopefully look forward to with Sansa eventually addressing the Littlefinger question, and I wonder if some reckoning for what he's done to Jane Poole will pop up in that. There are many ugly layers to patriarchy, in this world and ours, and the sheer fungibility of women has taken center stage of late. In the last Tyrion chapter, we heard about the game of vows played between the Targaryens, Lannisters, and Martells for each of their children's hands. It's not me they want, thinks Sansa very often, but my claim. Though Tywin Lannister is not satisfied with this shitty aspect of the social contract, he wants it to be even shittier. He's not swapping one noble lady for another. He's ripped a girl from the gentry, from her family, forced her into sexual slavery, and now has her dressed up as her best friend's sister. Everything about Jane has been stripped away to be Arya. She even mimics Arya's lip biting in an attempt at verisimilitude. The name and sigil she carries is false coin, but money is a construct, and Tywin and Roose accept that construct, so it will do. For now. For now. As we will explore even further in A Feast for Crow, Tywin, and to a lesser extent Cersei's, attacks on society's underpinnings will ultimately undermine their regime. The Lannister hegemon is in shambles after the last published books, but if and when the Northern lords find out what game Tywin and the Boltons have been playing, well, let's just say that's probably another vote for Northern independence.
I had forgotten that we don't actually learn that it's Jane Poole in this chapter. Which makes sense, like Jaime barely paid attention to the Stark girls, he's not gonna know that one. Oh yeah, you're Sansa's little friend. Theon is the one who identifies Jane when we get to dance, which is appropriate because of how that ties into his own identity struggle, how he's Reek on the surface and Theon underneath. In this chapter, Jane is anonymous, which here works to emphasize how the identity of Arya Stark is being imposed on her. She could be anybody, it doesn't matter. The point is the name, a lie on which we can build something real, this alliance with the Boltons in the North. That gray cloak, the wolf clasp, pinning it together, they're signifiers, like the sword Tywin gave Jaime. And just as Jaime feels more alienated from House Lannister than ever, the name of Stark is a prison for Jane. These are performances, lacking authenticity. And something I noticed as I came back to Jaime's chapters is how authenticity has suddenly become really important to Jaime, as mm-hmm. he's seeing and thinking more about himself. The horses won't let him ignore the blood soaked into the ground from the duel. And it's not Oberyn's blood. It's the blood of the nameless stable boy that Gregor killed. Now, that clearly haunts Jaime, although he converts his sorrow into anger, as he always does. A lesson he learned about masculine performance of emotions. I can't feel sad or grieve. I can't feel sadness. I can't feel grief. I have to convert it all into anger, convert it all into violence. That's what Cersei asks him to do in this chapter. The stable boy won't be part of the legend of that duel, any more than Jane Poole's real name. And her suffering that you talked about under Littlefinger, it's only implied even when we get to dance. It all happened off page, like Theon. And that, I think, ties here into kind of the story Jaime wants to write about himself. Who's going to be in that story and who isn't?
Jaime does seem to have a solid relationship with Steelshanks through all this, something we noted way back in Jaime 6. These are the type of men Jaime can easily relate to. Adam Marbrand very much fits into that same mold. If Jaime wishes to be a diplomat, to be a player, these are the type of people he can work with because they share that same martial language and habit, even if they hold little power on their own. Like how he gets along with the non-shitbag half of his Kingsguard. This is a strength of Jaime's. He may not be able to fight with steel like he did, but his past to some degree has bought him purchase with the military class. The chapter stops halfway to air an episode of Pycelle MD, getting a Clegane medical update following the trial. The mortification description is quite disgusting, something I imagine makes my co-host's fingers tent in excitement.
Now, why would you say that? I can't imagine what you're
doing it right
about.
Now.
I'm doing it right now, folks.
His screams are keeping the Red Keep up at night, and I wonder what's more terrifying, Gregor's screams of pain or Lysa's screams of ecstasy. Plenty of time to get to Frank and Clegane and feast, though, so the real important bit is Tywin's lone appearance in this chapter, one of his last in the series, really. In a few words, George is able to puff up Tywin Lannister even more, saying that he could cow even the stranger. It's making your villain seem extra invulnerable right before he shits himself to death, quite literally. Tywin is so steadfast, as immovable as Casterly Rock itself, that our characters act as if he's a constant of the universe, that he'll always be there to organize society.
Like Jaime thinks at Riverwell when it starts to snow, he wonders how his dad will feed the country, and then he remembers that his dad is dead. Mm-hmm. Like I was saying earlier, what I really like about this chapter is how George handles all the exposition, all the little scenes, just a masterclass in smooth, elegant storytelling. One I wanted to highlight that Jaime is talking to Steelshanks. He watches the Bolton soldiers ride off with Jane, and then he sees the blood of the stable boy that Gregor Clegane killed, mm-hmm. and that leads him into thinking about what's happening with Gregor Clegane. So then he can flashback to Tywin and Pycelle's conversation, which covers a lot of stuff that has nothing to do with anything else in the chapter, but it's been introduced very naturally because you can imagine Jaime seeing the blood, thinking of this scene, and then it cuts back to him going into the tower to talk to Cersei. I can easily imagine a much clumsier version of this, and this all flows really smoothly. And as Jaime thinks about it, Gregor is now suffering for his sins, and he'll be reborn as one of the Kingsguard. I don't know if it's ever in the works for Jaime to find out about that, but I always wanted him to, because as Jaime's trying to make the Kingsguard, you know, a more honorable institution, then this is what Cersei's doing to it. And not appointing Gregor would be bad enough, but appointing zombie Gregor is somehow even worse. Like, we've gone from Sandor to Gregor to zombie Gregor. Like, there's a sliding scale purely in terms of Clegane's on the Kingsguard. Amazing. But, you know, that kind of more religious, moral, Gregor is suffering for what he's done perspective, that's not how Tywin thinks about this. Tywin is thinking about Gregor as a domino that could potentially topple his regime. He lays it all out to Pycelle. Now that Gregor confessed to murdering the Martells, Tywin desperately needs to make peace with Prince Durand, especially because Stannis is still out there as an alternative monarch if the Dornish get really pissed off. And the only way to make peace with Dorne is delivering Gregor's head. So if Gregor dies before Tywin can execute him, the war just might start up all over again. And to an extent, this is just a reflection of the inherent fragility of peace, something George will explore at length in A Dance with Dragons, with both Danny in Slaver's Bay and John at the Wall, that even when you're doing your best and everyone's has good intentions, it's still really hard to keep everyone from fighting each other. But it also reveals Tywin's specific idea of the glorious Golden Lannister regime as a house of cards, continually undercut by his own brutality despite his intelligence. As he reveals here, he's very intelligent. He's a strong politician. He's thought this through. But the only reason it's a problem is because he keeps sending his pet monsters to kill everybody. Like when Stannis ends up going north, you know, he doesn't exactly do well with the Northern Lords, but the only reason he does well with any of them at all is because of the Red Wedding, because so many of the Northmen are like, well, we don't like Stannis, no one likes Stannis, but we're sure as shit not signing up with Team Red Wedding. Mm-hmm. He looks better as an alternative, which is exactly what Tywin is worried about here. And that's the kind of the fly in the ointment for his little victory speech.
We learn of the rift between Jaime and Tywin when Cersei makes her last appearance in A Storm of Swords. Before moving on to that, let's chat a little bit about Cersei, as the next time we see her, we'll be seeing the world through her eyes. Like Tyrion, she's been marginalized as a power player ever since Daddy's return to the capital. She's still up to her plotting in the margins, especially for Tyrion's show trial. But relative to her being the main antagonist to the hands of the king in the first two books, this is an ebb in Cersei's prominence, an ebb that will flow the other way as she emerges as a point of view character with full interiority in A Feast for Crows. The meeting teases out yet another main plot from Feast, that of Margaery and Cersei battling over Tommen. But here and now, Tywin has arrested her character for moving forward, or maybe more accurately, is pushing for regression, as Daddy Dearest wants to ship both the twins back to Casterly Rock so he can have sole possession of the king and thus the levers of power. This goes beyond Tywin wanting to be the sole puppet master. He does need to secure Casterly Rock within the main family line. It is the source of so much wealth and prestige and a symbol of the steadfastness of Lannister rule. With Tyrion bound for execution, Jaime needs to put aside these dumb ideas about serving and duty and just do what Dad tells him to do. Very few characters in A Storm of Swords have gone through the transformation Jaime has, save maybe Davos, who went from crab food to Hand of the King. I like to think about this chapter in relation to Jaime 1 and what first chapter Jaime would think about last chapter Jaime's problems. Jaime expressed how mad he got about that stable boy being hacked to death during the trial. Would Jaime 1 Jaime give a shit at all? Does Jaime 1 Jaime give Brienne of Tarth his own Valyrian steel sword and send her out to save the Starks? Of course not. And I think here, most of all, with Cersei, we see that radical shift in him. Imagine Jaime, with two hands soaking up the sun in his first chapter, being given a chance to live with Cersei like Casterly Rock, far away from Tywin's eyes and palace intrigue. That Jaime was single-minded. All he wanted to do was fuck Cersei, however he could. 8 chapters later, George has cultivated a much more robust character out of the Kingslayer, to the point where refusing to leave all this behind and run off with the sister lover is not only something we can understand, but hell, kinda cheer for. Not that Jaime is over Cersei. Even here, he invokes the Targaryens and wishes he had killed Robert himself. As he says, he's not ashamed of loving her. But it's a start to a more severe separation between the two, emphasized at the end of A Feast for Crows when he burns the letter she sends him. Cersei unties her hair as the author ties up the last of the cat's paw dagger mystery, a truth we already saw coming. We were just given the actual how and why that motivated Joffrey. Perhaps the more interesting part is how Cersei cuts to the point right away. You can say many things about Cersei and many things about her love for Joffrey, but she's not oblivious to the type of kid he was. Cersei's attempt to get Jaime to white sword plow her falls short thereafter, and they part ways talking about Tyrion. Jaime doesn't believe his brother or his sister would ever lie to him, but Cersei laughs that off. She's told 1,000 lies and one to her twin, just as Tyrion surely has. This angers Jaime, but more so perhaps this is the push to come forth with the truth about Tysha. If his brother never lied to him, as he believes, then it's only right he reveals the one he told to him, right? It is here that George drops the most iconic line of the chapter, about how Jaime has lost every familial and personal connection he's had in the process of House Lannister winning the war. Jamie may be being a tad dramatic in this moment, as, as Tyrion is still alive and he could mend his relationships with his father and sister lover. But ultimately, this is the weight war hangs on our relationships, how it frays, how it divides, how it ruins. Something on an even more intimate level we see in Fire and Blood and House of the Dragon, where the war is waged within a single house itself. We've seen the decimation of the losers of this war, namely the Starks, who have at this point lost their kingdom, their castle, their patriarch, matriarch, and heirs apparent. But the winners are more isolated from each other than ever, and that winning coalition between Lannister and Tyrell is starting to come undone, highlighted by Cersei's paranoia about the Tyrells. Like I try to say every episode, the politics here are constructed around the personal, so the results and backlashes of waging that war are going to necessarily rebound against the personal relationship of those who wage that war.
And Jaime walks into the room with all those concerns, the many kind of the backlashes, the possibilities for peace, the possibilities for war, everything we've seen in this chapter, and they all fly out of his head as soon as he sees Cersei. And the writing is so great that George lingers on the details, just the intense eroticism of the emeralds matching her eyes and the wind in her hair, mm-hmm, the way the clothes tighten against her skin. And this is all Jamie wants to pay attention to. This is how he got away with an unexamined life for so many years. I think it's George playing with the chivalric romance, the forbidden love that you can't get past because of your vows. Lancelot and Guinevere kind of, I think, being the, mm-hmm, the archetype of this. But George ramps that up when you have them, not just a knight lusting after his queen, but a brother lusting after his sister. And Jaime's starting to see the relationship differently. Like he thinks that he wanted nothing more than to take her in his arms. But he doesn't do it. Because as he realized in an earlier chapter, he realized that she never comes to him. And that they think about their relationship differently. Jaime sees Cersei as a distraction from politics. Something personal, something authentic, something real. It's only us in the world. But Cersei clearly sees Jaime as an extension of herself, just like their children. Something she can use as a tool for politics or really anything else. Like Tywin, she doesn't think that anything has changed between her and Jaime. And she doesn't think anything has to change. All I have to do is give him a sword, Tywin thinks. All I have to do is play with his other sword, Cersei thinks. And neither of them care what Jaime thinks. As with Tywin contradicting himself when he was trying to justify the Red Wedding to Tyrion, Cersei jumps between different arguments here, even as she feigns sincerity. She tries to get Jaime to object to Tommen marrying Margaery by playing up to his paternal feelings. Tommen's your son, protect him. But as Jaime says, Cersei always prevented that relationship from developing. She can't fall back on it now. There's nothing authentic there. She's just saying whatever might convince him to see her way in the moment. The only relationship Jaime ever really had was with Cersei, and it ruined his relationship to everything else. Jaime's ashamed, he says, that he threw Bran from the window to protect them. But the thing is, if it wasn't Bran, it would have been someone else. Like, Jaime and Cersei were taking that risk every time they got together. If anyone saw them, Jaime would kill them. It's that political-personal dynamic you were talking about. Personally, if Jaime and Cersei were just two random people, they might be able to get away with this. I think, you know, there's still a taboo there. Mm-hmm. But there wouldn't be as much on the line. There wouldn't be the stakes involved of them getting caught. The same way I said about Stannis and Renly, that if they were just two brothers fighting over their toys, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. It's only a problem when the toy is a castle. And Jaime is irrational about that problem. Like, he's unwilling to accept the reality that because of their power, they will never be allowed to live as a couple in public. And Jaime says, well, the Targaryens did that, which is so ironic given that Jaime is the one who ended the Targaryen regime. And the Targaryens only got away with that at first because of dragons, and then when they didn't have dragons anymore, it was just kind of habit. They'd been doing it for 150 years, and not all of them were marrying their siblings or cousins, so they could get away with it. The Lannisters have neither dragons nor the habit of letting them just do whatever. Jaime is delusional about this because he can't stand the thought of never getting to be his honest, authentic self in public. But Cersei is also delusional about the politics writ large, thinking she can avoid being married, thinking she can keep Tommen a child forever. I mean, these were always impossible goals, but Tywin's presence makes that difficult for her to ignore because Tywin can just tell her what to do. Something you really see in A Storm of Swords is that really the kids should all gang up against Dad. Mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. He is the source of all of their misery, but he has power over them. Cersei wants to fuck the pain away, but Jaime can't do it here in the White Tower. Which, is also, I think, at some level irrational. I think Cersei's right. We did it in the Sept. It's not like that's like, it's not like if we got caught there, we'd be fine. If we get caught here, we'd be in trouble. But the Kingsguard, the White Tower is almost like the Sept for Jaime, because this is his religion. This is knighthood, and the Kingsguard is his religion. He believed in it as a child. He strayed from the church as it failed to be what he thought it would be. And now he's back. He can't defile this snow-white place, because then nothing really means anything. And then that means Brienne was right to reject him early in the book. And I think it's great writing on George's part that when Jaime rejects Cersei, she's, before she gets angry, she's confused and she's scared. Because she never thought Jaime would act independently. She never thought he'd be outside her sexual control. That saying no is a big moment for the Lannisters, who are so accustomed to their power. Jaime said no over and over again to Tywin. No, no, no. How many times do I have to say it before you'll hear it? Or with Cersei at the end of Feast, there's a bit I love when she's going to the High Sparrow and wants Osney Kettleblack back, and he just says no. It's like a splash of cold water to her face. And it's this awareness of, it's this belief on the other Lannister's part that Jaime is only acceptable as long as he's in their control. And so Cersei lashes out and brings it all back to manhood, that you're not really a man. They took hacked off your dick with your cock at Harrenhal. And gender roles are central to this relationship and to the kind of the Jaime Cersei Brienne triangle. We'll see more of in Feast. Brienne talking about how she felt like she could never be son or daughter for her father. Or Cersei saying here that Tywin really never had a son. I could have been it, but I lacked the cock. Not only saying Jaime's not a man, but also saying Tyrion's not a man. Cersei just doesn't love the man Jaime is now. And back to what you said about how Jaime's line about losing the war is really about losing relationships. Like, that's really what Jaime has lost. And he's finding out too late that he actually cared way more about those than he ever cared about winning the war.
He shouldn't be that upset, though, because for all the families he's lost, he's got Brienne of Tarth, who is worth about 50 Lannisters, not including Jenna Lannister, who is a perfect angel who never did anything wrong besides marry a Frey, which was probably not her fault. And well, after a chapter without Brienne, Jaime is more than happy to see her again, so am I, even if he greets her with his normal barbs and negs. He notes how much better Brienne looks in her current woman's wear, even if it's a bit uncomfortable for Brienne, and Jaime actually vocally compliments her on it. But it's her eyes that continue to blow Jaime away. Astonishing eyes, he thinks, even though he keeps that one to himself. Brienne is up for this sparring, as she compliments Jaime on getting all cleaned up, looking quite dashing in his white cloak, though she has to squeeze these comments in around Jaime's self-deprecating humor about soiling it. Note to the boys out there, the girls do not like you constantly putting yourself down. I'm not trying to be super heteronormative, but this encounter here between two of the fiercest warriors in Westeros feels a lot like prom date, seeing each other in nice clothes for the first time. Mm-hmm. And in terms of courting someone, Brienne and Jaime are about as experienced as high school seniors, albeit for different reasons. But it's exchanges like this where I think Brienne and Jaime transcend the shipping discourse and plant their flag as an actual romance in this story, an OTP in George's mind as much as in the community's. Jaime catches Brienne up on what's been going on during her brief imprisonment. They, along with Loras, touch on the mysterious death of Courtney Penrose, which, if nothing else, helps these three characters start to square the circle that surrounds the deaths of Penrose and King Renly. The mystical element is beyond them, but a clearer picture does emerge regarding the road that paved Stannis' way to King's Landing. The more pressing news Jaime has to relay is Faria Stark's journey north. He needs to impress upon Brienne that she is not Arya, and that she can't get distracted chasing down that little lie of Tywin's. Jaime does have to explain to Brienne that Lord Bolton knows he's being paid in quote-unquote false coin, as she says, and I do think that metaphor is apt. Like I said earlier, money is a construct that exists as long as it is seemingly backed institutionally, whether by fiat or tied to a bundle of goods or whatever. But it needs buy-in collectively to properly function, just like other social constructs such as the feudal contract or gender. The Lannisters, as I discussed earlier, have been upending norms and fraying that social fabric. Tywin Lannister for decades with his brutal military tactics and eliminationist warfare, and Cersei more recently in how she handled Robert's succession, Barristan's removal from the Kingsguard, etc. This regime will disintegrate after Tywin's death, leaving the Seven Kingdoms in shambles and allowing for the rise of a newly defiant Ironborn, and most importantly, a potential Stark restoration.
So Jane as Arya makes for a great synecdoche of all the ways that Tywin has undermined the feudal order and why it cannot be maintained when that one man holding it all together returns to the mud. So that brings Jaime to what he actually wants Brienne to do, even if she can't help assuming Jaime has less than great intentions as he draws out his plan to save Sansa Stark. But even if she's a bit slow to the point, I'm really charmed by her sussing out that Jaime believes his brother to be innocent and the hard smile Jaime returns. These two are growing closer and know each other better than perhaps anyone else knows them. This is especially hitting Jaime because just moments ago, Cersei admitted to lying to him 1,000 times over.
It's that real authenticity I was talking about. This is the real relationship Jaime actually has that has developed organically and definitely not in a healthy environment, but in an environment where they needed each other and they got close to each other on the basis of that need. And it's just a beautiful capper to their relationship that's been developed so well throughout this book. And of course, they won't see each other again until a brief reunion in A Dance with Dragons. But already, I think you can see here George thinking through these characters and thinking through where he wants to take them next, because this scene is basically the inverse of that earlier scene with Cersei, or every scene with Cersei and Jaime. That's the triangle we're going to see in A Feast for Crows, is Jaime caught between trying to be more like Cersei and trying to be more like Brienne, while Cersei and Brienne have their own storylines going in Feast, of course. And you can see it, George, sum it all up with one sentence, close the door and come here, which is exactly what Jaime said to Cersei at the beginning of the first book when Bran was eavesdropping, and Jaime wanted Cersei to close the door, come over here, and fuck him. And now he's saying the exact words to Brienne, but with a different kind of sword being shown here. Here, Jaime isn't committing the great taboo sin, the incestuous relationship that has sparked a war. Here, he's trying to create a different kind of relationship. Here, he's trying to defend one of the Stark children rather than throw them from a window. So this is almost the redemption for that earlier close the door and come here scene. And it's not just Jaime. Loras is also embracing his best self, that he's getting rid of his resentment toward Brienne, which was really clearly just a violent expression of grief for Renly. And Loras is starting to age out of that very kind of childish, unleashed approach to violence. We don't get to see his conversation with Brienne, but I imagine that it was her grief that got to him, that it was so clearly not fake, that it was the genuine, the authentic, the real deal, everything Jaime wants. And Loras still isn't sure it was Stannis, because the Shadow Baby story is still crazy if you weren't there. But as we see here, the subsequent mysterious death of Courtney Penrose adds to the evidence. And, you know, Loras probably is thinking, well, okay, I know Brienne didn't kill him, so clearly there's something else going on. Really, though, I think Loras just decides to accept the mystery, and he can't sentence Brienne to die if he doubts her, which makes me think about Ned's speech to Bran about the importance of killing yourself, about the importance of taking on the act of killing other people yourself rather than relying on headsmen to do it, relying on paid executioners. And what Ned said to Bran was, if you're going to kill someone, you owe it to look in their eyes and hear their last words. And if you can't do it, that probably means they don't deserve to die. And Laura seems to have realized that here, that I can't bring myself to kill her. And that means she's probably telling the truth. And Jaime kind of is talking about Brienne the same way, that he's seeing her differently, and he focuses on her eyes, her astonishing blue eyes, the eyes that are the window to the soul. And I think part of what's going on there is that Jaime is aware that Brienne sees him differently, and he focuses on her eyes as a way of seeing himself differently. It reminds me of Othello and Desdemona in Othello, and how when they court each other, Desdemona is just talking, swooning over Othello and his military reputation, all he's done. And Othello, like, clearly just falls in love with her version of himself. Like, he falls in love with how she talks about him, because that's also his romantic conception of himself. And that's kind of the relationship Jaime and Cersei had. And now we're seeing a relationship where the two people can change each other and make each other better. And Jaime cares about how she sees him. And it's very nervous. It's very awkward, this scene. It's despite all they've been through together, they're still like this because neither one of them wants to be vulnerable. And so they keep interrupting each other. They keep making these negative assumptions. Like, there's the big one that Brienne makes about Jaime wanting to kill Sansa. But there's also, even earlier in the conversation, the bit where Brienne is saying the white cloak, and Jaime's like, yeah, now I look terrible in it, I still stink, whatever, whatever. And Brienne's like, no, I was going to say it becomes you. Like, each of them is assuming that the other person is about to insult them. So neither one can realize that that that's not what's happening. And Jaime, like you're saying, keeps talking himself down. I'm the bloody Kingslayer. That's a, like a horror vouchsafing for your maidenhood. Mm-hmm. And kind of covering up his desire to keep Brienne safe. Like when he says, I didn't want you to go off and get yourself killed for nothing. Like he's finding the most cynical, sarcastic way of expressing, please don't get yourself killed. I love you. I don't want you to get hurt. And there's the little bit when he thinks, when Brienne's like, why are you telling me this stuff? These are your father's secrets. And Jaime thinks, well, the Hand. I don't have a father. He's lost his family. And now Brienne is the only family he has left.
Mm-hmm. I really do love that line about a whore vouchsafing for a maiden. It reminds me of that Salador San quote about how smugglers have to vouchsafe for kings now. Mm-hmm. It just got that same kind of flavor to it. Jaime has a present for Brienne, which I mentioned he whips out at that moment. And that word choice was intentional, not only for the well-trodden phallic sword metaphor, but because this is the height of intimacy these two share. Brienne is both nervous and enchanted with this deal, you know, kind of in the way two teenagers are before they get down on prom night. She picks it up gently at first, curling her fingers around the hilt. It's incredibly sensual. Oathkeeper, Jaime needs a blade, but it doesn't come freely. Brienne keeps thinking Jaime wants her to capture and return Sansa to Cersei, or maybe outright to kill her, which Jaime has to constantly tell her to, like, let me finish. You can't really blame Brienne, though. It's not like Jaime has a well, you know, a well of goodwill he can draw water from. This sours his mood, though, and he's ready to dismiss her, but because, you know, he's in love with Brienne, he has to send her away with words that get right to the heart of it. You'll be defending Ned Stark's daughter with Ned Stark's steel. This resonates not just because it honors their vows to Catelyn Stark, or because Jaime looks to have committed to his face turn, but because someone, finally, is seeing Brienne for who she is, for who they want to be. Catelyn Stark started it, but Jaime is finishing it. This isn't like Renly, who viewed her as absurd and gave her a Rainbow Guard cloak because she won the right to ask for it. It's the person she shared a close tie with charging her with a mission to save the Maiden Stark, a mission that has the potential to rock several of the kingdoms depending on Sansa's fate. And only Brienne can be trusted with this. Only she is capable of this in Jaime's eyes. It's a vote of confidence in who she is as both a person and warrior that has rarely, if ever, been afforded to her in good faith before. But there's more. Beyond perceiving Brienne and giving her purpose, Jaime is investing his own last hope for chivalry in her. Sansa Stark is his last chance at honor, and he trusts his honor in Brienne's hands even more so than his own. Or hand, I should say. Hidden underneath all the jokes about Kingslayer sticking together is that the truth is Jaime and Brienne are now bound to each other in ways that extend beyond mere duty or feudal arrangements. In the same breath that he trusts Brienne with everything, he downplays his relationship to his dead son, Joffrey. Brienne has been elevated above even his blood, just like you were saying, she is his family. Brienne grasps this just as she grasps a sword, as exiting stage right until a feast for crows, saying she will find the girl for Jaime's sake.
And that's a moment with such heat that they have to walk away from each other. Like that's as close as they can get to expressing their feelings. This has been such an intense, intimate relationship in this book. Their parting could easily feel anticlimactic, and credit to George that it doesn't. I think the key is that even though this is an act of love on Jaime's part, he doesn't admit it. He can't admit it. Even though Jaime resents Brienne for assuming the worst, even as he falls back on his old insults for her in response, I think part of him is glad she makes that mistake, because that means Jaime doesn't have to express his true feelings. It's easier to call her wench. It's easier to demand that she call him Kingslayer back. Even though he hates that name, he's used to it. It's familiar, it's easier than being Jaime Lannister, the flawed, fragile human being who can't use a sword to keep the demons at bay anymore. All these assumptions and expectations have led Tyrion to conclude that he may as well be a monster if people are just going to look at him like that anyway. And Jaime doesn't go that far. He is still doing the right thing here, sending out Brienne to save Sansa. But it gets him so angry to think that even that might not be enough to change his reputation, that he will always be the Kingslayer. And if that's the case, why expose himself? Why put himself out there if Brienne is going to reject him? And Brienne clearly understands immediately that that's what happened, and that's why she keeps trying to apologize as the scene comes to a close. She saw a glimpse of a new man, and reacted to the old one. And that hurts Jaime so badly, in part because the new man only exists because of Brienne. Like I was saying, that's the triangle in A Feast for Crows, the Brienne-Jaime-Cersei triangle. Which of these women will Jaime be like? And here he makes the choice. Not only does he give away the sword Tywin gave him, rejecting House Lannister and his own martial image, but he does so in defiance of Cersei. Like, he's not just trying to keep Sansa safe from anyone, he's specifically trying to keep Sansa safe from his sister. And there's a powerful ambiguity here in that Jaime himself does not go off to rescue Sansa. He wants Brienne to be his surrogate, his best self. Mm-hmm. He does the right thing, but he says the wrong words. Jaime's still a complex character to unravel, which is George's ultimate point, is that he is now fully human in our eyes. And Brienne's.
And so now we bring down the curtain on Jaime's A Storm of Swords point of view chapters, though not his entire arc. Like many of these point of view closing chapters, Jaime 9 affords us a moment to look back on Jaime's journey through Act 1 of A Song of Ice and Fire, and thanks to the White Book, we get to do that quite diegetically. He starts, rather clumsily, to fill in his own history that we are now privy to, from his failure at the Whispering Woods, to imprisonment and maiming, to being saved by Brienne. But for all that's happened, there's still 3/4 of the page laying blank, an enormous white space not unlike the cloak hanging from his back. The Jaime Lannister in his 9th chapter is not the Jaime of his first. That first chapter is about Jaime being freed from his literal bondage, but for the first time, here, Jaime feels unshackled from his lot in life, and can write a new story for himself, in a manner of his own choosing.
Yeah, this is definitely a very meta moment, a very kind of breaking the fourth wall moment for George, where he has Jaime Lannister, the character, be in the position of the author of Jaime Lannister. He's writing his own life. He's writing his own story. He's thinking about what's going to come next. He's thinking about his life in narrative terms. And that's George's own blank page, of course, that has only grown blanker and blanker over the years. But that's, I think it's kind of himself saying, this is kind of George directly addressing his Gardner writing style and how he doesn't always know exactly where he's going to take a character. This is him kind of saying, this is why I do that, because it's so thrilling, and because whatever we choose, me and Jaime together, it's thrilling, but it's also terrifying for Jaime, because it means he's really taking responsibility for his life for the first time since he killed Aerys, that big decision that made him go, okay, maybe I shouldn't make choices anymore. And in terms of the context with Tyrion 11, it's so interesting that as Jaime looks to the future, this blank page of possibilities, he's drawn back to the past. He's drawn back to the decisions he's already made and his changing perspective on them. And it's so fascinating, I think, that Jaime's relationship with Tyrion is, up to this point, that's been his most redeeming feature. Like, that Tyrion loves Jaime and that Jaime treated him kindly. That they always think fondly about each other and take inspiration from one another when they're continent apart. But as we're going to learn in Tyrion's last chapter, that relationship is also built on a big lie that brings the whole House of Cards crumbling down. So I tip my hat to George that even as he seems to wrap up Jaime's story so far here, he's actually just opening up a whole new vista mm-hmm. for him that we're going to get into as we go.
So moving on to foreshadowing and groundwork, Jaime teases the idea of getting Sir Ilyn Payne to be his training partner, which we know very much becomes the case in his point of view chapters in A Feast for Crows, when he brings Sir Ilyn Payne along for his journey through the Riverlands to set the kingdoms at peace. I really love this relationship. It's not like Ilyn Payne can do much. I just remember his like weird clicking laughter that I love. It's one of those things I wish they were able to adapt into the show beyond just other choices. Wilco Johnson, the actor who was Sir Ilyn Payne, he was going through cancer treatment at the time, so he couldn't fulfill his role back on the show. They shifted it to Bronn, which I think the actors did fine with each other. They were kind of paired up together for the last several seasons of the show. Good relationship, but it's, you know, kind of two smart ass guys together, so it's not quite the same dynamic. You like having, like, Jaime is a guy who maybe, I wouldn't say talks too much, but he's definitely kind of a chatty, witty, you know, you want to hear what he says kind of person. And Sir Ilyn Payne being the opposite, or Brienne of Tarth in this book kind of being the opposite of Jaime, really helps that like two-handed relationship come alive.
I love that comparison, that he's replaced Brienne with Ilyn Payne, the symbol of death. But yeah, I think that relationship is a very literary one when we get mm-hmm. to A Feast for Crows. I don't think it would necessarily work in television to have just the one silence and the one guy talking. I think you can do that in one scene for like a comedic effect, but I think coming back to it would be difficult mm-hmm. Just from a writing perspective. But it works great. It works like Jaime is now, he has no one to talk back to him, and he's kind of just stuck in his own skull and repeating himself, and he's confessing things still in pain that he wouldn't say to anybody else, but he's not kind of getting much out of it. It works really well, and I think, yeah, with Jaime and Bronn, that's more kind of television banter, but yeah, they're basically the same guy at some level, so that's you don't have the opposites attracting that you get with Jaime and Brienne.
And the other big bit of foreshadowing in this chapter is Tywin noting that Stannis has sailed from Dragonstone. Yeah, it feels like ages since Davos 6 or whatever. So what? It's like you almost forget Stannis is around. And, you know, George has dropped a couple hints here or there that, you know, Lysini pirates are here or there or moving around. But it's, you know, it's still pretty much a surprise, as we'll talk about next time when Stannis shows up at the wall. Like, I was just not expecting it. But, you know, here you kind of see George is like, don't forget about this guy. I wrote Stannis for a reason, not just to give you Davos chapters.
Yeah, it's a great balance he has where he sets something up because he doesn't want to cheat or have something completely come out of nowhere, but he also wants to surprise the first-time reader. And I think this is a great example of it, because if you pause to think about this as a first-time reader, when Tywin says Stannis is sealed from Dragonstone, you do actually know where he's already going, because the last Davos chapter ended with him with a letter from the Night's Watch. That's already there, but this is happening so quickly in a scene that's already a flashback for Jaime in this chapter, and they're not even actually talking about Stannis. They're actually just talking about Dorne, and they don't want Stannis to get involved with Dorne, which isn't what's going to happen anyway. So George has just like buried this with layers of misdirection and distraction, so you don't realize what's about to happen. But he's too scrupulous to have no one mention that Stannis sailed from Dragonstone. He's kind of like, I gotta put that in there just so I'm playing fair. That's classic George behavior. So moving into theory and discussion, this is where Brienne gets hold of Oathkeeper, the sword she takes all along the way through A Feast for Crows, fighting some bloody mummers with it. And in her last chapter, she's given the choice by Stoneheart to hang alongside Podrick Payne and Hyle Hunt, or declare sword, take up Oathkeeper, and kill Jaime Lannister. So doubt that's going to happen, but I was wondering what you thought about Oathkeeper in general within the story, whether there's going to be something else important involving it, whether Brienne's going to kill somebody important with it, and just where it'll end up.
That's interesting. I don't think the show was entirely wrong and just say Brienne keeps it for the entire time. I don't think it changes hands. And I do like the idea that she protects Sansa with it, like going forward. I don't exactly know how Brienne and Sansa are going to cross paths at this point, but it's, you know, very possible in the works. I like the idea. A theory that I articulated a long time ago was the idea that the continent of Westeros would break in half, and then you would have like a kingdom in the north, it would possibly a Queen Sansa, and it would be kind of cool if she's defending the queen in the north with Oathkeeper, while whoever's protecting Bran in the south is doing so with the other half of Ice, hopefully not called Widow's Wail anymore. But
give it a nicer name.
And I do, I another thing I'll give the show credit is I do think Jaime getting Widow's Wail kind of makes sense, maybe. At least he's a sensible person to actually just wield it for a while, or even carry it around ceremoniously, even if not using it so much. The thing I would be looking for is, do those two swords intersect again? Do the two parts of Ice come together in some kind of metaphorical or symbolic manner, in whether it's protecting a Stark kid or fighting back the White Walkers and fighting back the winter? I think that's what I'm looking for, but it just feels like the Brienne and Jaime story is going one direction, and like the whole thing with Sansa Stark is going a different direction. That kind of how they're going to like get those two to come together is kind of where I'm not sure where it goes from there.
Yeah, I think Jaime getting Widow's Wail made sense to me in the show. I think it makes sense in the books too, that you have Jaime and Brienne kind of as kind of these split figures who have a lot in common, but a lot they don't have in common. And so having them have the two halves of the sword makes sense. I think, yeah, just logistically, in terms of everyone's storyline, it works differently in the books. I could also see like someone like Sandor getting it. I think that would work out fine. But yeah, I think Brienne using it to defend the Starks. Maybe she runs into Arya first, since Arya will probably be swinging back through the Riverlands at some point to pick up her wolf. I think, you know, Brienne, I think being the one to take down Stoneheart is a possibility, and Oathkeeper would be how she did that. I think, as we've talked about before, Arya seems like the candidate that fits better there, kind of her version of what she did to the Freys in season 7 of the show. And then, yeah, Brienne, I think, holding on to it as a gift from the Starks. I could easily imagine the scene when she tries to return it to Sansa or to Arya, to Jon or someone. They say, no, that's yours now. Because it's in the same way that that they are changed by their experiences, they are just different swords now. Like, they're not Ice. They are, you know, Oathkeeper belongs to Brienne and is part of her story. So I think using that as kind of the symbolic synecdoche for her character as a whole, I think is a good choice.
I just had the thought, like, we have that romantic line here, you're protecting Ned Stark's daughter with Ned Stark's steel, but imagine if she kills Ned Stark's wife with Ned Stark's steel. Like, that would be something George would do. And right. Obviously, I think we would view the killing of Stoneheart as more of a mercy than anything. So, and, you know, that can be poetic as well. Like, she's, know, kind of putting to bed, you know, the memory of Catelyn Stark with, you know, something, a Stark blade, so...
Sure. And that you know, her oaths to Catelyn versus Jaime, she's getting into the same conflict Jaime himself felt about that oaths that contradict each other. So that is going to wrap us up for our episode on A Storm of Swords, Jaime 9. Thank you so much for listening. As always, if you want to drop us a rating or a review in your podcast app of choice, we really appreciate that. It helps new listeners find us. You can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/notacastASOIAF, where our patrons get benefits including early access to our regular episodes and exclusive episodes every month. You can shoot us an email at notacastASOIAF@gmail.com. And you can follow us on Twitter, Blue Sky, Instagram, etc. at notacastASOIAF. And you can find me at Poor Quentin.
And I'm Manu at Manuclear Bomb.
So coming up next on the Nauticast, my next Star Wars episode, we're going back through Empire Strikes Back right now. Our fifth one is going to be out for all of our $5 and above patrons next week, covering the end of Luke's training on Dagobah with Yoda before he flies off to Cloud City. A couple weeks after that will be our next episode on Fever Dream. We're almost done with George R. Martin's 1982 vampire novel. So our next episode covering chapters 32 and 33 in that book will be out for patrons in a few weeks' time. And then in between that, next time in A Song of Ice and Fire, it's A Storm of Swords, John 10, in which Jon Snow, poor Jon Snow, has to deal with multiple kings at the same time. He just can't catch a break.
Can't hear you. All I'm hearing is Stannis, 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 Stannis. That's going to just be us for an hour and a half on next episode.
And someone popping in to go, Robert, as John thinks of his Ron Weasley. It'll be perfect. So thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time in Westeros for A Storm of Swords, John 10.